I was born and raised in New York City. My father immigrated from Scotland and went from Ellis. It is. Is there only one switch? It's on. Green light is on. Don't tell me I failed already.
Yeah, you're good to go. Although I can't tell. Yeah, you're good to go.
My dad moved from Ellis Island across the bay to Staten Island, pastored a church there for 47 years. So I come from a very rich, Scottish, long-term pastoral background. Had no inclination toward ministry. Had one of those wonderful high school experiences where I loved math, got a free scholarship to go to Brooklyn Polytech. After the first year, my dad said, would you go to Bible college for a year and see if the Lord has anything for you? I did. If you ask me why I went back the second year, I probably couldn't tell you. The third year, it was pretty early. I mean, pretty easy. Her name was Shirley. And we've been married for 50 years. And my last verse is, surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life. Now, I tell you all of that just to let you know that I do come from a very strong pastoral background. I pastored for 10 years before I went to teach at Cedarville, and then I spent 23 years in Grand Rapids at Grand Rapids Baptist Theological Seminary. We have an Asian program. That's where these backgrounds come from, and I kind of like these backgrounds. I want to talk to you this morning in the first session a little bit about how to understand what's going on in the culture. And then in the second session, to try to ask the question, what changes should we contemplate in ministry plan in order to address a postmodern culture? We're all familiar with the Enlightenment. 16th, 17th century till about 1960 was the dominant Western worldview. Okay? And it had certain characteristics. It was a time period when man developed the ability to control a great deal of nature and a great deal of science. It was also a time in which the Industrial Revolution came, and the Industrial Revolution allowed us to harness machinery, to cut down the nature of human labor, and we have all benefited from it. But it was also the age of reason and careful analysis. This is the time period when higher criticism was birthed in Europe. This is the time period that the Bible became scrutinized by the standards of human reason. And it could also, of course, be called the rationalistic time period. It was the age in which science came into its own. And the kind of science that developed was a science that said, everything is in process, and all process is progress. It was very optimistic. We had the notion that as science learned more and more, the quality of life would get better, and the problems in society would lessen, and especially if we could get universal compulsory education, we could cut down on crime, cut down on poverty. And, of course, this was a very optimistic age. And science today still, I think, carries many of those connotations, even though there have been some changes come. This was a time period that aspired to absolute objectivity. Scientists would say things like this: we don't have any presuppositions, we just follow the facts. And you religious people, you're biased because you have presuppositions and you're not open to follow the facts with us. And we lived in a time period in which we were told that science was neutral. It had no anti-religious bias. And as a consequence, we needed to somehow adjust the Bible to fit what science was learning. And of course, we went through a lot of attempts to adjust the Bible to fit contemporary science during that time period. It was the age of critical evaluation, where the structure of the human mind was the standard for all truth judgments. It's the time period in which we came to the place of our present understanding of the boundaries of nations, of state organizations, and of everything that we're fairly well familiar with in geography. But it was primarily the age of individualism and autonomy. Autonomy is built, if you're not familiar with the word, from two Greek words, auto, nomos. Auto means himself, nomos means law. Himself, the law. We have just witnessed a debate over Terri Schiavo. Right? The first criteria that the medical profession are taught in order to make ethical judgments in medicine is the autonomy of the patient. The judges said there was adequate evidence that Terri Schiavo would not wish to live in her present condition, and that her condition was irreversible as far as the clinical people who were providing the information, and therefore for 14 days she went without nutrition and hydration. I don't know what her death certificate will read, but I want you to know she died from the complications of hydration. She didn't die from brain damage. She died from the fact that once that dehydration got to a point, her kidneys stopped functioning, everything in her body became toxic, and it took her life. This is the time period where we have all lived with the notion that every individual is ultimate. And I hate to say this to you, but we have almost adopted that notion in our approach to evangelicalism. Take the phrase, "Do you know Jesus as your personal Savior?" The church has almost become a conglomerate of individuals who volunteer to be a part of this body. It's amazing to me. Everyone who believes is baptized by Christ with the Spirit into the body. Is that true? It's not volunteer. There is no such thing as a believer who has not been baptized into the body of Jesus Christ. Is that correct? We allow this individualism to take us too far to the right. As the changes are coming in culture, the reaction to it is going too far to the left. We lost balance because we thought we could accommodate the gospel to the age and offer Jesus on this kind of basis. This is when Protestantism came into being and became institutionalized in denominations. And of course, it's very clear today, is it not, that we are moving to a very strong post-denominational kind of situation. No one has any loyalty to any historic patterns. You know why? It might hinder your growth if you use a denominational name on your church. Therefore, you use other kinds of names. It's just very interesting. The seminary that I was a dean of for 22 years has taken Baptist out of the name, and it's now Grand Rapids Theological Seminary. If you ask the reason why, I'll tell you why. Because the operative dynamic is bigger is better after all. And if we get that Baptist out of there, we'll get more people. And we all know that the only way to know God is blessing us is by head count. This was the age of capitalism and consumerism. The Lockhorns had a funny cartoon in the paper recently. Loretta came home from shopping, and Leroy says she bagged her limit. Well, this is so normal to us, isn't it? We live in a disposable, consumerist culture. We live in a culture of waste. We live in a culture that has almost concluded that capitalism is a divinely sanctioned, divine methodology for every nation of the world. May I tell you, on the new earth, we are not going to have a democratic, capitalistic society. It's kind of interesting when you contemplate that. Well, as you know, we've been going through a worldview crisis in America. There's been a shift. The phraseology that is used is to describe the Enlightenment as modernity, and then from the 60s, we got the little word post-modernity, which started in Europe, where most things start, and it started as a literary theory, and it was Jacques Derrida, the French literary critic, who developed deconstructionism, which became an immediate academic success in America. It's gone now. Deconstructionism didn't last long in the university literature departments, but the end product of the philosophy behind it remains very strong. Probably the most important philosopher in postmodernity is Richard Rorty, R-O-R-T-Y. He's about my age. He calls his philosophy social pragmatism. It is the most common expression of postmodern thought, and we're going to explore that just a little bit. What happened was, in the 60s, unbeknown to us, the culture went through some shifts. Initially, they weren't very detectable. But now, as postmodernity has developed, probably the average American who's in the 50, 60, 70-something age categories thinks, whatever happened to America? And they all want to go back to what it used to be. And they get nostalgic. And we kind of conclude that if we could reverse Roe versus Wade, America could go back to be what it used to be. I want you to know that's not true. If you're going to wait to go back in order to get the work of God done, you'll never get it done. We're living in a different time period. We're going to have to understand the culture we're in. Because we live in it doesn't mean we understand it. Because mostly these cultural changes have come very incrementally and very slowly. So much so that they're not detectable as major changes. So the first thing you find is that there's a revolution in science. Remember that nice Newtonian world we knew? Where the smallest particle of reality was the atom, and we knew how to split it and control it, and we could predict its speed and location at any time by the use of mathematics? Well, postmodern science says there's mystery at the heart of reality, and Newtonian science has been patently false, and that evolution could never explain what has transpired in the created order. It's amazing. They now talk about indeterminism, and they talk about quarks, Q-U-A-R-K-S. Now, a quark isn't what that Aflac duck says on those commercials, right? A quark is a component of reality that can be identified just at the edge of where the next step leads you to mystery, where you can't identify, predict, or handle reality. This indeterminism is being used in physics. You say, how does it work? Well, it works as well as a model. Here's the application of Einstein's theory of relativity to physics. One thing postmodernity has done, it has really challenged the science of the Enlightenment, and Newtonian science in particular. So that's the first thing. Secondly, just as in the Enlightenment, in postmodernity there is no basis for morality and values. In the Enlightenment, there was no place for it because values and moral judgments can't be dissected through empirical science and therefore their statements of personal preference, they have no objective reality. We were sold the bill of goods that in education, teachers teach facts and not values. May I say to you, that's one of the most foolish statements you could ever hear in your life. Because the first thing you do as a teacher is decide what you're going to teach. And guess what determines what you're going to teach? Your values. So that every lesson taught is an expression of values. And this dichotomy between facts and values in the Enlightenment. But now we've got a different pattern. I'll wait a minute to discuss it with you for another slide. They argue that although things are in process, progress is not inevitable. We're going to have the reintroduction of some nihilism into our culture. It's already here. Nihilism from Nietzsche, right? That there's something ultimately that can't be grasped rationally and can't be controlled, and therefore you come to the boundary of what seems absurd. What we're facing now is looking and thinking about that. And they have an interesting critique. They argue what causes us to think we're making progress is technology. I can remember when I first started teaching that my hands were always dry because I used the chalkboard a lot. Now look at the technology we have. Is this an advance? It certainly is. But because we make these advancements in technology, it creates the aura that society is progressing when actually society is being denigrated. It's going backwards. So they have a cogent critique. They have an interesting phrase. I hope my language doesn't bother you. They call technology a whore who promises what she cannot fulfill. And they have a very cogent understanding of how technology continues to create this notion. This is what is the most dominating and new thing in postmodern viewpoint. It is that there is no basis for truth. And we want to think of truth with a big T. In the Enlightenment, you could have truth if you pursued the empirical world using all the forms of induction. If you are a little bit more rationalistic and not so empirical in your orientation, in the Enlightenment you could have truth, like Descartes did. I think, therefore I am, and from that he proved the world and God. You can start with something in the mind, something solid, and move deductively from it. We had both of those traditions operating in the Enlightenment. Now, the view is that there is no standard for truth judgments. All truth is socially formed in a group. So there is no such thing as transcendent or absolute truth. Therefore, if you look at the homosexual community and their desire to legitimate same-sex marriage, there is no known standard whereby you can judge their viewpoint inferior or superior to yours, and therefore it's going to have to be accredited as an alternative lifestyle, and it will be enfranchised as a minority with rights. The point isn't that somehow they don't think they have the truth, and somehow believers don't think they have the truth. The point is, both that community and the believing community, their truth is socially formed in the group they live in, and there is no ultimate truth that can judge between them. Now, this is what's devastating. It's the first time in the history of Western philosophy from the 6th century B.C. until the 1960s that we have ever come to a place where in the discipline of epistemology, the science of knowledge, that we now have no standard. So it is a fascinating time period. Yeah? Don't think I'm being negative and pessimistic. I'm I'm delighted to be alive. I wish I was going to be alive for a few more decades as this continues to develop and to see what we can do to address it. The language of public debate has been lost. Okay. There was a day in America when the language of public debate was Christian worldview language. Now the language of public debate is kind of the political correctness language. Pastor Vandermeulen almost made a gaffe. He said he remembered me when I was young. The implication is I'm old. I want you to know I am not old. I am chronologically challenged. That's how the language goes. It's a language you're going to have to learn if you're going to address this culture. This culture does not know the theological language that you use. And as the 20-somethings go into the 30-somethings and the new 20-somethings come out of the university, it's going to intensify. So there is a sense in which we need this. The meaning of written texts have been lost, and there is limited autonomy. About the only autonomy the person has is perhaps at some point in life to choose to leave one social group and to enter another social group. But no one lives in isolation. This is where the stress now goes on community. And the community's stress is the basis for the formation of truth. Two other words that are used to describe this are multiculturalism and pluralism. There is another word, globalization, is a fourth word that often carries the notion of postmodernity with it. Where did diversity come from? You remember Genesis 10 and 11. I don't know, what are we? 300 years after the flood? Universal, devastating, catastrophic judgment because of man's rebellion against God. And out of a large population of people, God found only one righteous, perfect man on the earth. How could that have happened? So the judgment comes because the intent of man's heart is evil continually, and you can't begin to understand the meaning of the phrase when God looks at what's going on and he says he repents that he ever made man. After the flood, God said, multiply, fill the earth. The people said, we don't want to scatter. We want to stay together. And guess what they did? They built a what? A city. Guess what Cain did after he was driven from the garden? He built a city. Here's the origin of man's city. What did Cain call his city? Remember? He called the name of the city the same as the name of his son, Enoch. Now you know Enoch in the line of Seth, right? Seventh from Adam. He walked with God and God took him. Here's Enoch, the son of Cain, and Cain has built a city and named the city after the name of his son. The word Enoch means to inaugurate, to initiate. Here's man, post-flood, rebellion against God's command, building a city and a tower that's going to reach to heaven, a ziggurat. Believe there's irony in the Bible? The ziggurat that's reaching to heaven, God says, let us go down. We don't see it. Where is it? Let us go down and see the city and the tower. And God said, because they have common speech, nothing will be withholden from their hand. With common speech, they can produce another universal rebellion against God. So God confused their understanding, and they were forced to scatter abroad. Here's the origin of diversity, of multiple cultures. Is that right? Multiple cultures are a part of the purpose of God. It is not only a judgment, but it's a manifestation of grace. Because where there's multiple cultures, there won't be one common universal rebellion against God. There'll be the Islamic rebellion, the Hindu rebellion, the Buddhist rebellion, whatever else you want to name. But they'll have no agreement between them. So the diversity certainly is a part of God's sovereign purpose. Secondly, I can say, the tolerance is an aspect of common grace. That without it and common grace, we couldn't have community and we couldn't have society. Is that true? If God allowed depravity to run its fullest, there would be no human society. If you'd like to think about hell, think about God removing all the restraint on evil and letting it run full course forever without abatement. Okay. So, tolerance has always been a part of being able to live together in community. They're not asking that you tolerate. Postmodernity wants to take a step beyond that. Postmodernity wants to say there is no basis to make truth judgments, and therefore it's not just toleration, it's the realization that what you think you have for truth isn't ultimate truth at all. This is what they would say to you. Can you step out of history and your social conditioning to get a look at the whole? What makes you so arrogant to think that having been formed in history, you now have transcendent truth, or truth with a capital T? So the issue today isn't we must tolerate other cultures. The issue today is those cultures are no different in their social structure than your evangelical culture. They have their dress style. They have their food. They have their art. They have their music. Hey, it's getting familiar now, isn't it? They have their cult, their creed. They have their practices. And there's no way you can look at them and say, you know, if you don't quit that and come to this community and believe in Jesus, you're going to end up in judgment. I hate to tell you this, but pretty soon in America, it's going to cost to insist that Jesus is the only Savior of men. Postmodernity is going to take America to a missionary situation if it's not already there. And this is what we struggle with. And, of course, when you respond to it and you try to argue that there are standards for truth, then, of course, you're the enemy. You're the bigots. You're the people who are arrogant. You're a blight on the community. I was flying back from O'Hare to Grand Rapids, and Shirley and I joke and say when the Lord comes, we'll have to change at O'Hare. Because every place I go, I have to go through O'Hare and change planes. And sitting next to me is a gentleman that I introduced myself to by name. He gave me his name. And he said to me, what do you do? And I said, I'm the dean of the Baptist Seminary. And he looked at me and said, you're the kind of people I hate most in the world. You're the most bigoted. You're a blight on the Grand Rapids community. I said, what do you do? He said, well, I'm the international vice president for sales for Steelcase, office man, furniture manufacturer. But he said, I'm also the spokesperson for the gay lesbian community in Grand Rapids. And I said to him, and I don't recommend you ever do this, I said to him, have you ever asked yourself why people like me bother you? If what you're doing is okay, why should people like me bother you? I said, well, maybe it's because you're a creature of God, and deep down, no matter what you say, you know what you're doing is immoral and sinful. Well, he almost went through the ceiling. The flight attendant told us we had to keep our voices down. Okay. All I did was take Romans 1 and 2, right? I'm not recommending it. But, you see, that's how you're perceived. You're perceived, if you insist that there is that truth and you have it, you're going to be perceived as the enemy. You're the intolerant people. You're the arrogant people. You're the ones who are going to be the most difficult to deal with when postmodernity comes to its fruition. I think postmodernity is here for at least another 4 or 5 decades. Okay, let's go ahead and keep building on this. Multiculturalism is the new agenda called social pragmatism. Unfortunately, we know so little about it, and it's still rather amorphous, that we can't detect when we sit in front of the television, even watching the news shows, that these things are being managed and delivered from postmodern starting points. Now, I was amazed last time I was in Singapore. I'm sitting watching television in Singapore, and the amount of postmodern material communicated in Singapore was just amazing to me. Now, Singapore is the most westernized of Asian cities, but you find it now moving from the west to the east. Globalization. This probably lets me state it as well as I can. Every culture has its story. And there is no overarching story that can judge one culture's story as inferior or superior to another culture's story. The two points where the judgment can't be made is truth and values. Values. Axiology. So you have your story. Right? It starts in Genesis 1, is going to end in Revelation 22. Right? Here's the narrative. Here's the basis. And it is in this overarching story that we think is a standard to judge all other stories that puts us into the hated position of arrogance, of being bigoted, and everything else. And of course, there's some very basic questions that need to come out of that. This is an agenda that has permeated the mass media. The news is managed this way. A lot of what's coming out of Hollywood and film is managed and is communicating this kind of understanding of values. Certainly in children's programming, it's just amazing to see how this gets all the way down to the cartoon base. It has become ensconced in the university. Now, when I say that, I mean among the younger profs who are assistant and associate profs, and they're not yet department chairs or in charge. But the department chairs are still enlightenment people who are in control to some degree, except in the schools that prepare teachers. In the teacher ed programs, the agenda of postmodernity is ruling right across the board. Okay. And it's going to impact all public education. It's already impacting it to some degree. But let another decade go by. When I look at America, and there's no way that this statement can be judged for truth or falsity. When I look at America, I would say about 60% of Americans are still committed to the Enlightenment. And about 40% of Americans have imbibed the spirit of postmodernity, even though they may not be able to articulate it. Okay? Most of us don't change worldviews by going through a conscious process. Most of us change worldviews incrementally through that which influences us. In the next decade, I think those numbers will be reversed. about 60% will be postmodern, and about 40%. And then within two decades, there'll be a very small minority of Enlightenment people left. But of course, it has also penetrated the political agenda. Even the No Child Left Behind, even with a president who has evangelical commitments, the Federal Department of Education and how the money is used is committed to multiculturalism. The lesbian gay community get almost 80% of their funding from your tax dollars. Okay? You wouldn't believe that, but there are lots of sites on the web that will demonstrate where that funding comes from that they have. This agenda probably is best manifested so far in the healthcare reform material that Hillary Clinton and her friends put together. If you wanted to talk about a quintessential postmodern cult couple, Bill and Hillary would be it. Bill doesn't need to be feared. Hillary is a brilliant woman, philosophically astute woman. They would manifest it. Remember Bill's whole conflict with whether or not what he did with that intern was actually wrong because of what words meant, and you can't know truth, and just amazing. So that would be one way. You say you're a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. No, that I'm not saying the Republicans are the good guys and the Democrats are the bad guys. I'm just saying to you, if you want to think about its manifestation in the political arena, it's there, and it is in the federal education agenda. We've got to move quick. In light of this, in theology, we've had the development of something called post-foundational theology. And this came in light of a critique of evangelicals' commitment to the Enlightenment captivity. And some of this critique is cogent, and some of it we need to pay a great deal of attention to. The new approach toward a post-foundational theology has been the work of Stanley Grenz. Now, I regret to tell you that 3 weeks ago, Dr. Grenz, 55 years old, died of a brain aneurysm. Dr. Grenz is a brilliant man. We will lose a person that has produced a great deal of material that causes us to think. But he is the man who wrote the book After Foundationalism. If you've not read that book, it's a book that's something you need to be aware of. Okay? The emerging church is a manifestation of an attempt to take post-foundational, post-enlightenment theology and ecclesiology and develop a new model to address a post-modern culture. And I think we need to rethink our biblical theology from the perspective of biblical meta-narrative. Brian McLaren, pastor of a church just outside of Washington, has written a book entitled A Generous Orthodoxy. If you read it, Why I'm a Missional, Evangelical, Post-Protestant, Liberal Conservative, Mystical Poetic, Biblical Charismatic Contemplative, Fundamentalist Calvinist, Anabaptist, Anglican Methodist. Don't you just love that? It's a very generous orthodoxy. But this is an important book. This book is having a big impact. You can get all of this at the Zondervan website. Zondervan has become the major publisher. Is Brian McLaren a bad guy? Absolutely not. Is he my brother in the Lord? Yes. Is he a gracious Christian gentleman? Yes, he is. Do I dislike him? Absolutely not. Okay? here's a new book that has just come out. And this book is written by a professional philosopher who claims to be a devout evangelical. And it's written at a serious academic level. And it is the first attempt to defend the emerging church by addressing the content of what postmodern philosophers teach. It's not going to be a grassroots level book because it's written a little bit above that. But it certainly is a very helpful book to read. If we talked about the emergent church, they deal with thesis antithesis. Have you come across Robert Weber's book, The Younger Evangelicals, yet? Oh, let me turn my back so you can shoot arrows at me. A part of ministry has to include keeping up with what's going on in the culture and not assuming because you're in the culture you know what's going on. Sorry. I want to say to you, some of this stuff we're going to have to read or else we're going to find ourselves in trouble. Nothing is ever said to be incorrect. In a Time magazine interview, they asked Brian McLaren what his view was on same-sex marriage. Here was his answer. "That's the kind of question I refuse to answer because no matter what answer I give, I will hurt somebody." Is that how you would answer? Well, this is the emphasis now. The emphasis in this is that we're not interested in theological precision. Now that the emphasis will be on experience as opposed to rational truth, feelings and affections will take control, inquiry and solutions will be gone, story will replace propositions. If Brian was here, and he would say to you, "On Sunday, do you have a point for what you're going to preach? If you do, throw it away. Do you have 3 points under it to make the point? Throw them away." That's to be controlled by the spirit of modernity. The church doesn't need to listen to endless propositions. The church needs to be able to respond to story. Every culture responds to story, doesn't it? May I ask you, how much of God's revelation is a narrative? 82% of the canonical scriptures are narrative. Participation instead of auditing. Would he be doing what I'm doing? No. He would look at what I'm doing and say, "Oh, Greer, haven't you caught on to anything we've said? You're doing rational solutions. You're doing everything that constitutes the church's cerebral captivity." Witness now needs to be bound to life, not to words. Community versus individualism and consumerism. There's a high value placed on integrity and authenticity as opposed to theological accuracy. The new words are abduction. You know what induction is? You know what deduction is? They reject both as being enlightenment. We need to emphasize abduction. How many of you ever used that word and know what it means? Okay. It's a fine English word. Well, it's there. Abduction has to do with that emotive, aesthetic aspect of man's being, whereby he responds outside of the cognitive categories. And that's a side of reality we don't deal with. You know the old saying, don't wipe out bacteria. It's the most culture that evangelicals have. It's terrible. Aesthetics. Mystery. Mystery is so important. Don't you realize that with all of your propositional preaching in everything you're doing. You can answer every question and get rid of every contradiction. And there's no mystery left to Christianity. That's why so many evangelicals are going to the Greek Orthodox Church. That's why so many evangelicals are going to the Roman Catholic Church. Because no matter what you say, there is something mystery in the sacraments. And all of that has been lost because of the Enlightenment captivity of the church. And it's been a great loss. You say, are you trying to get us to believe this? No, I'm just trying to represent it honestly. May I skip this slide? Because we've kind of run out of time here way too quick. Sorry. In fact, I'd like to skip all of these. You can read them. They're pretty self-evident. Here's the emerging church's view of ministry practice. They want to recover aspects of the liturgy that was jettisoned by modernity. They want to use icons. They want to use incense. They want to go back to some of the structures of worship that existed before the Reformation and before the beginning of the Enlightenment. They want to remove Christianity from its cerebral captivity as propositions to believe. They want to replace the cognitive with the aesthetic, embrace abduction while rejecting both deduction and induction. They want to say truth springs from relationship and is always akin to feelings. That's probably the most important thing I've told you about it so far. Truth springs from relationships. When you tell stories, you're telling relationships. When you witness, it is more your relationship with the person out of which truth will come than the propositions you communicate to them. Monologue sermons are over. Right? Now everything is going to be multisensual and the media is going to be heavily used. Services are going to be more interactive. The story format, dialogue format, the standing in a pulpit and taking a text and opening it and preaching it, that monologue kind of approach has been our captivity to the Enlightenment. Here's my preliminary evaluation. Believe me, it is very preliminary. In my judgment, they view postmodernity only in its most popular forms, and they don't seem to penetrate to the philosophical base of it. Many of these leaders come from a bad experience in right-wing fundamentalism. Maybe you've had some bad experiences there. Postmodernity, in my judgment, is accommodated without ever confronting its non-Christian aspects. They don't seem to grasp the full epistemic crisis that postmodernity propounds. That is, there is no capital T truth. And that we ought to just take our place as another social group and demonstrate through our relationships with each other and with other people that our social group and our understanding is that out of which through our feelings we have come and people will be attracted to join us. That's pretty well the method. The character of the form and content of the words of God is set aside for media that speaks to this generation. This probably will change a bit. This is what they accuse us of. Doctrine is the center of our theology. And the 10 loci of systematic theology is the boundary. And if you don't hold our 10 loci, you can't fit in the boundary and be a part of us. Stanley Grenz wanted to say community is the center and boundaries are fluid. They don't ever ultimately get fixed. I'd like to suggest maybe the center is Christ, and maybe the boundary is the interpreted biblical meta-narrative and not our reconstruction of it in systematic theology. And in the second session, I'll spend some time trying to help you understand what I think that means. You've got to be exhausted. It's already a few minutes before 11. Now, why don't we just take a break, talk with each other. We'll start with any interaction you want to have with me. And if we don't get through the second session, that's fine. I'd be very happy if in the end product of this, we started to be able to critically evaluate what's going on in our culture and to be able to identify it when it comes to us. So let's take a break.